team.
Yeah. Well, if we can all, we'll all chant the Heart Sutra, which is this text that I think was given out yesterday. Thus I have heard once the Blessed One was dwelling in Rajagriha at Vajrapigma, together with a great gathering of the Sangha of monks and a great gathering of the Sangha of Bodhisattvas. That time the Blessed One entered the Samadhi that expresses the Dhamma called profound illumination, and at the same time the Lokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, while practicing the profound Prajna Paramita, soaring this way, he saw the five skandhas, the empty of nature, then through the power of the Buddha, Venerable Shariputra said to Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, how should a son or daughter of noble family train who wishes to practice the profound Prajna Paramita? Addressed in this way, Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva said to Venerable Shariputra, O Shariputra, a son or daughter of noble family who wishes to practice the profound Prajna Paramita should see in this way, seeing the five skandhas to be empty of nature, form is emptiness, emptiness also is form. Emptiness is no other than form, form is no other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, perception, formation, and consciousness are emptiness. Thus, Shariputra, all dhammas are emptiness. There are no characteristics, there is no birth and no cessation. There is no impurity and no purity, there is no decrease and no increase, therefore Shariputra, in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no perception, no formation, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no appearance, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no dharma, no eye, dhatu, atu, no mind, dhatu, no dhatu of dharmas, no mind, consciousness, dhatu, no ignorance, no end of ignorance, no old age and death, no end of old age and death, no suffering, no origin of suffering, no cessation of suffering, no path of wisdom, no attainment, no non-attainment, therefore Shariputra, since the body suffers, have no attainment, they abide by means of Prajna Paramita, since there is no obscuration of mind, there is no delay, transcendence, and attain complete nirvana. All the Buddhas of the three times by means of Prajna Paramita, fully awakened to unsurpassable true complete enlightenment. Therefore, the great mantra of Prajna Paramita, the mantra of great insight, the unsurpassable, the unequal mantra, the mantra that comes all suffering, should be known as truth, since there is no deception. The Prajna Paramita mantra is said in this way. Om Gate Gate Para Gate Para Sam Gate Bodhisattva. Thus Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, should train in the profound Prajna Paramita. Then the Blessed One arose from that Samadhi and prayed, Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, saying, good, good, O son of noble family, thus it is, O son of noble family, thus it is, one should practice the profound Prajna Paramita, just as you have taught, and all the Tathagatas will rejoice when the Blessed One has said this. Venerable Shariputra and Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, that whole assembly and the world with its gods, humans, asuras, and gandhas rejoice and praise the words of the Blessed One.
So today we talk about students. Nothing much to say. I mean, already a lot of things have been said because they are very, very interconnected. As we speak yesterday in the morning, it is actually students' motivation. The teacher must have the motivation to enlighten the student. That should be teacher's, guru's main aim. Nothing else. The rest are all if there's anything anything good, then you can consider it as a bonus, so to speak. Likewise, the disciple, the teacher, and the student aim is to seek enlightenment. There's a fair amount of confusion from the student, especially within the Tibetan Buddhism, and probably also the Japanese and all that. Anyway, there's a fascination towards Gautama Buddha and his words, his teachings, of course. But along this, there's also fascination towards culture of all these Eastern cultures. Fascination towards colorful Indian culture, chaotic Tibetan cultures, bare, simple Japanese culture, orderly kind of Confucius Chinese cultures can be quite fascinating. And this fascination and the fascination towards the words of the Buddha can get confused. And most of the time, as Padre Rinpoche said, fascination towards the culture takes over. And that's how one loses contact or touch with the Dharma, the Buddha's words. Because the Buddha's words, as you have just been reading Heart Sutra, now this is the quintessence of the Mahayana Sutra. no nose, no eyes. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. There is no ceremony in this. Maybe the closest ceremony that it talks about is the mantra, mantra of the Prajna Paramita. There's no culture. While we cannot sort of do without the culture, even if one wants to, it is almost unwise. Not to base on a certain culture. This is the sad thing. I'm saying this is unwise because you will not find a way. You cannot read Hat Sutra. You cannot read the Hat Sutra, contemplate on the words, without depending on the master, tradition, culture, teachings, some kind of tools. Unless you are already accomplished, which means you have already been groomed in certain tradition, certain path. It is almost impossible to get the benefit of the Hat Sutra, for instance, without depending on some kind of a method. But the point is not to think that culture methods is the essential or the dharma. This quite important. Many masters are quite eloquent when it comes to culture and the tradition, and maybe not so much when it comes to the dharma. But whenever that happens, masters, teachers these days tend to promote the cultural aspect of the spiritual path. And this is a big deception, because probably it's not really necessary. Well, again, as I have always been telling you right from the beginning, there is no black and white judgment I can make. If your Tibetan master prescribes you that every day before your meditation you must have a cup of butter tea, and if that happens to be as some kind of a skillful means, straight coming from the wisdom and compassion of this master, then that is a skillful means that is prescribed for you. And this is what you have to do. But not everybody has to learn how to make butter tea just because you are following Tibetan Buddhism. I kind of see this happening. And sadly, this is actually within the liturgies, within the institutional kind of documents. If you read prayers, aspirations composed by the Tibetan masters, they will have prayers like, may this and that lineage be flourished. This lineage, the only best, the most supreme lineage, may it be flourished. A little outdated and almost not necessary for Australians. It's a Tibetan issue. It's not an Australian sort of issue. I'm emphasizing this because Tibetans are very good at teaching sectarianism. Very good at that. I myself find, shockingly, I'm quite good at teaching, you know, sectarian thinking. And that's not necessary. Anyway, for the student seeking the enlightenment, that should be the primary goal. If you have that, trust, devotion, renunciation, bodhicitta, all the things that we are supposed to practice should not have any difficulty to arise within ourselves. Okay. For instance, faith, devotion, belief or trust. Let's talk about that because it's quite an important one. Saraha's interpretation of devotion or faith is what you should notice. When the Buddhists talk about devotion, we are talking about trust in cause, condition and effect. That's the interpretation or the definition of devotion. Yeah, I've explained this several times before. When you cook an egg, you know, let's say if you are boiling an egg, you know you need water, pot, fire, matches. There are certain cause and condition you must have in order to boil an egg, like water, you must. You cannot boil an egg without water. Of course, egg itself is the most important, isn't it? But water. And then a fire probably is one of the most important. There are some other conditions that if you have it, it will make it nicer, more easier, such as kitchen. You can cook an egg right on the street, but very uncomfortable, very messy, and in the process the egg will maybe not be cooked properly. Unless the cook is skilled. We don't want to rely on the cook so much, do we, these days? Oh yeah. Cook is quite important in this case, as you can see. The This is why I think the guru is almost must. Now, when you have a cook, some water, fire, pot, egg, all of that, and when it is boiling, and when you have a time when the water is getting really hot, you have, even though if you pray that it will not be cooked, prayer will not be succeeded, because all the cause conditions are there. It will be cooked. No choice. So when we cook an egg, what do we have? We have a devotion. When the water, pot, cook, when all these are gathered, we have a certain confidence, isn't it? Certain knowledge, confidence, or trust that, oh, I can cook an egg because I now have a water, pot, egg, fire. You will not complain like that. If you don't have a kitchen, you can still say, oh, well, it's okay. Even though I don't have a kitchen, I can still cook an egg. You see, this kind of confidence, this is what we call devotion. This trust. Trusting to cause, condition, and effect. Effect, the outcome. What will happen? That's devotion. And that is the kind of the trust or the devotion a Buddhist student must try to have. Again, for that you need to hear information. We have talked about that yesterday. Hearing, contemplation. You have to hear that in order to cook egg, you need water. That kind of knowledge you have to hear first. Then you can contemplate on it and then actually perform yourself, which is the meditation. During the cooking of an egg, the main aim is egg being cooked, isn't it? That's the main aim. But, yes, so in our practice, during the meditation, during the spiritual path, main aim should be enlightenment. Main aim should be enlightenment, but that means a lot, okay? That means so many things from different angles. This could mean let's come from a different point of view. Desire, anger, jealousy, all these negative emotions. When we have that, you have to learn, at least through hearing in the beginning, that all these negative emotions can be destroyed. How? By educating yourself again and again, those things come from conditions, causes. Those are not inborn nature. They are not permanent. They are compounded phenomena. They are manipulatable. They are, if depending on how much I emphasize, how much effort I put, they can be changed. like that, again and again. And then develop this sense of trust that, yes, this looks bad, this looks tough, really, when it comes, especially at times, crankiness erupts. It is something, by law of physics, by law of whatever, karma, by law of cause and condition and effect, it is something that can be manipulated. That is actually not only trusting to the path of the enlightenment, that is actually believing in enlightenment. That is a belief. Not only to the path, but even to the result. You are believing that it can happen, and that's what you want. That kind of trust you must have. Devotion is so important. Gagyupas, they say devotion is the head of the meditation, they call it. It's very true. I want to stress this because devotion seems to have some kind of a negative connotation. Something to do with a blind faith, sort of blindness. Like you kind of believe in whatever he or she or the path says, isn't it? You do not ask questions, you do not... Yes, you do not analyze, you just believe. This also exists. Okay? This also exists. But this exists after, this should exist after you have finally convinced yourself that egg is cookable, that my emotion is destroyable. After that, at least intellectually, once you have that confidence, then it is sometimes, actually many times, better just believe to the master or the path, because you don't have time. Clock is ticking all the time. Okay. And also, you see, for instance, you want to learn how to drive. First, you must believe in yourself that you can drive. You have two hands? Yes. Two feet? Yes. Eyes? Yes. Mind? Yes. Some kind of a sanity? Yes. You know, language availability? Yes. Then you go and ask someone to teach you how to drive. And then he teaches you. With your hands and feet and eyes also comes other attributes of yours, such as nervousness or sleepiness or distracted to other things like fishnet and stuff like that. You understand? Then the instructor will say, instructor, if your good karma leads you to a good instructor, he might say, okay, look, from tomorrow onwards, before you drive, I want you to have a cup of coffee. Let's say if the instructor thinks you are very sleepy, not alert enough. You should not go back home and read the signs of your motor engine, or you know, like where is coffee mentioned? You understand? Because it's not going to help you. It will just delay your time. Tomorrow you're going to ask, why did you ask me to drink coffee? It's not written there. And it doesn't make sense. I want to learn how to drive, not drink coffee. Stuff like this. It will just kill your time unnecessarily. First, you believe that you can drive. Second, you believe that he has the ability to teach you how to drive. After that, just do whatever he says. If he says, drink coffee, drink. If he says, you know, something else, you know, like use a brake with your hand, do it. Some amazing, you know, instructions could come. This is because of you, not so much because of him. That's why sometimes a lot of that is interpreted by others. Okay, now the other driving school students are watching you and him. And he's teaching you, drink coffee, use brake with your hands, you know, stuff like that. And they think, what is these two doing? And then they think he is taking you for a ride, is it? He's, I don't know, abusing you or taking advantage of you. And they try to tell you, are you sure? You know what you are doing with this guy? And you have one pointed, unshakable devotion towards him. And you said, yes, yes, you know, you guys mind your own business. Then they think, you are completely brainwashed. You are blind. You are completely, what do you call it, sucker? Yeah. And I think this second part of devotion is the most obvious devotion, and this has actually spoiled the first kind of devotion a lot. You know, I'm talking about two kinds of devotion. The first devotion that you can drive because you have all the attributes to drive. Second, this guy can teach me how to drive. Okay, I have the ability to drive. He has the ability to teach me how to drive. That's the first kind of devotion. Second kind of devotion is really following his instructions, even though it's not coming from the textbook. This kind of second devotion seems to have taken over the first kind of devotion too much. Not so good. Bad news for Buddhism. And do you know why? Because actually, many times we don't have a good instructors who actually knows how to drive. But they know how to say, use your hand to press the brake. And partly because of that. Devotion is important. Both, especially the first one. And then the blind one, you can call it blind one, but I'll rather call it time-saving devotion. Kind of, you know, just do it, you know, like, why ask too many questions? Because all this life after life you have been asking questions hasn't really led you anywhere, so just do it. That kind of time-saving question, devotion is really important. Very important. But this time-saving devotion comes naturally, if you have that first kind of devotion, trusting to yourself that you have the potential, therefore he can teach you, and by his teaching you have the ability. And again, I remind you, this all has to be based on one thing, that is wish to seek for enlightenment. The fundamental ground is really the most important. On the top of that, then we have all the other things like renunciation, mind, the revulsion towards the worldly life. All these are ornamental, really good. Good to have them. I have noticed among the practitioners, they have lack of the first kind of devotion, but they have some kind of a renunciation mind. This could lead to pointless depression. So, if you get hit by that, sort of think about this first kind of devotion. Thinking, I've done all this, been there, all this useless, pointless, I've done this. So what? Nihilist, pointless devotion is, pointless depression, sorry. Bit of nihilist. That's because of the lack of the first devotion. First devotion has to trusting to yourself first, and then the trusting to someone, which is also based on seeking for enlightenment. Actually, I must say, the renunciation is quite, seemingly renunciation mind, is quite strong in the West. I've noticed this. But maybe lack of trust in their own potential. So, you have to really, really bring the egg here. Whenever you have a problem with too much renunciation but lack of trust in yourself, this pointless depression, bring an egg. Egg is such a good example of ourself. Beautiful to look at, completely closed, of course, some more sort of eternalist oriented people have the other way and the other problem, other side, otherwise. Oh yeah, they also do have depressions. They have, instead of pointless depression, they have endless depressions. Many of my close kind of, I don't know, friends, students, they have fallen in love and they got married and stuff like that, and they come to me for blessings. And I've been telling them, you know, giving my best wishes. But told them they're more eternalist, these people. And I gave them an idea of three strawberries. You put one strawberry on the top of each other. First you have one, of course that sits well. Then on the top of the first strawberry, you try to put the second strawberry. Little bit of hardship, I mean without any glue or any sticks, huh? And it might work. The third one will not sit that easily. Almost not possible. In the midst of trying to put the third one, even the second strawberry falls. But the eternalist human beings, they just believe that one day the third strawberry will sit on the second strawberry. And one day, when they wake up, after millions of try, they are 50, 60 years old. So many nasty things has happened. But the third strawberry is still not on the second strawberry. This is what I call endless depression. So sad, really. Not so much time for celebration. I think in our life, you know, we try to build a lot of things. We try to build relationship, family, practice, friendship. Influence, money, whatever. One should learn that even the 10% of what we have, 10 or even 5% of what we have, what we are planning, comes through. Celebrate. But the eternalists, they don't. They don't celebrate. They like to celebrate when the third strawberry is on the top of the second one. And sad thing is, there are so many movies and books that talks about actually the third strawberry on the second strawberry. And that makes my friends, eternalist friends, believe that this will happen one day. I have a, what you call it, scant doubt that some of these friends of mine, they actually believe if they can't do it this life, they will do it, they will continue next life. I believe they write to each other, we will be together forever, this life, next life, stuff like that. Goodness. Anyway, we are talking about students. And I am also a student. I'm still. Okay. Few other points of what a practitioner or a student must have or should have. While, you know, I've been telling you that enlightenment should be our aim. That it should be the main aim. While that is, that should be your fundamental sort of ground, you, a practitioner, student, must also learn not to look for result. That's a difficult one. Because Gautama, Master Gautama said, as soon as you are looking for the result, then you know, looking, that attempt of looking for a result, that wish, that longing for a result, that longing for a result is, Gautama said, it's a sound of the knock at the door being knocked by devil. Well, devil in this case, of course, nothing external, but obstacle. It's an obstacle. It is like a magnet of obstacle. Looking for a result. It's the, like a magnet. You know, we talk about obstacles a lot. We have this obstacle, that obstacle. Why do we have obstacles? Because you are longing for a result. This longing for a result is so attractive to obstacles. They come. Longing for result. Meditation result. I don't know. Result of everything. Whatever you do, we are such a goal oriented. Har Sutra says what? Nothing to gain, nothing to lose. Yeah? What it is? No increase, no decrease. Anyway, result. This is quite an important thing, actually. This actually means enlightenment is not a result. Very big lesson to learn. Enlightenment is not a result. Oh, now we are talking something very high. It's not a result. If the enlightenment gets the label of result, enlightenment will hinder you. As we talked yesterday, a little bit, enlightenment is basically the final undoing the knots. Remember we talked yesterday, second bhumi is nothing but it is the undoing of the first bhumi. You undo, you dismantle the first bhumi and then you reach to the second bhumi. You dismantle the second bhumi, dismantle, undo, then you reach to the third bhumi. Tenth bhumi you dismantle, I guess it's conveniently called enlightenment. It's not a result. There are many points, but I extracted this because I think this is actually one of the main obstacles. Yes, and not only obstacle, it brings the obstacle. I'm not getting the word properly, proper term. What do you call it, this, when you make wine? Ferment? Yeah. Yeast, is it? Yeah. Yeah, result-oriented, or looking for result, ferments your path and produces obstacles. Very strong well aged, is it? Obstacles. Very subtle, just like wine. This is a difficult one. Ask me some questions about this. I want to know whether you understand what I'm talking. You are supposed to long for enlightenment. I mean, you are supposed to really aim for enlightenment and not look for the result.
So when you reach enlightenment, you don't celebrate. You just know you have it.
I guess so.
So therefore you're not celebrating the result?
No celebrations. Because I don't think you will realize. I don't think, it's a bit like this. I don't think you will realize that you have once upon a time not enlightened. You understand what I'm saying? When you are in the enlightenment. Enlightenment is a process.
Because the opposite of being goal-oriented is being process-oriented.
Maybe. You can say, what does process mean?
It means that you're in the act of doing or ongoing has no real goal.
Goal is not to have any goal. Difficult to explain this one, but very crucial for the student.
Yeah.
But don't think that you don't have to do anything. You have to. You have to do a lot of undoing.
Can you please use the microphone when you ask the questions so that we can record the question as well? Thank you.
I was asking about the process, which is often referred to as the path and the result. If we go through a process, a path to achieve a result, it is indicative of some sort of goal. I'm not suggesting that actually you have to, once you attain the result, you're oblivious to that result, but nevertheless we tend to refer to it as path and result. Mm-hmm. So why is it
okay
that we cannot expect?
I don't know how to explain this. What do we say, wake up from a dream? Do we say that, right? I woke up from a dream, good dream, bad dream, I don't know. Yeah, do we? It's a bit like that. Does a dream exist? I'm asking you.
Only in your mind.
But what has happened in the dream? Does it exist in reality?
No, once you wake up, there's no dream that exists. That's
so, wake up. It's very similar here. When you say, wake up, almost indicating that there was something to wake up from. But this is the only language we can use.
Well,
when you have a nightmare, you wake up. You even have a little bit of a relief, isn't it? But there wasn't anything like what was happening in the nightmare. So that relief was really unnecessary. That relief is pointless. That relief is baseless.
So you're saying,
and not only the relief, even the waking up is baseless.
So it's just a quality of ignorance that we actually have to call this path and result.
Yeah. We have no choice. That's the only way to talk.
Rinpoche, are you saying that because we feel relief when we wake up from a nightmare, for instance, we haven't actually woken up?
No, we actually, that whatever has happened during the nightmare hasn't happened in reality.
But I'm saying that when we're saying that you wouldn't congratulate yourself when you're enlightened or anything like that, there's
exactly
no sense of...
Mm-hmm.
When you're actually waking up properly, it's not like I've woken up. You're actually...
This is the closest example I could bring at the moment.
Yeah.
Wake up.
In the act of longing for enlightenment, then, we or I create a reference for enlightenment, so therefore I should be longing for referencelessness.
You see, this is the thing, this is a paradox here. You should aim for a state where you will not long for enlightenment. Yeah. difficult one. You should aim for a state where you will not long for that state. Difficult path. That's why all the path from the first noble, four noble truths to the Vajrayana, everything is just a placebo. It's all. Yeah.
Hello. Hello. Rinpoche, I find a contradiction and a paradox because in the path of the Mahayana, developing bodhicitta and getting a real sort of motivation going, looking at an object that needs compassion, whereas with taking the result of the path, or what I understand of Vajrayana, you sort of take away the object of the motivation, and I think I don't know which is more important, to have the motivation seeing as the object is real, or to sort of see that they're already enlightened. And
no, they're both important, they're both necessary. You have to initially, you have to have compassion towards sentient beings, okay? And then this compassion should slowly lead you to realize that there is no compassion, there is no sentient beings to have compassion to, things like that. That is very necessary for Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism. If you don't have that, your compassion is a theistic compassion, goal-oriented compassion, suffering-producing compassion, bleeding-heart compassion, left-wing compassion, testing animal against animal, this kind of compassion.
So when you're developing a motivation, you're aiming, you have a goal. It feels like you have a goal.
You can sort of slowly build it up. Right now, maybe for many of us, don't think about the emptiness or the no goal too much.
Okay, thank you.
But what I'm saying is, I'm putting this information in your head because I want to make a hole in your head so that at least you are ready when you hear the news. It's quite important. Otherwise, actually many I have countered after the years of practice, because of the lack of the information on emptiness, goalless, resultless, they have a strong grip towards for instance, like a Vajrayana, when we talk about Vajrayana, we pray to that Guru, have devotion towards the Guru. And suddenly, something hits you, like, oh, everything is emptiness. Guru is also emptiness. Who am I having what devotion with? Then you condemn yourself. Sacrilegious. How can you think like this? Please, Guru, forgive me. You are there. I don't mean to sort of delete you. Forgive me, you understand? I'm here, please. Be inseparable and all that. Padmasambhava Sanji said, when you think, when you suddenly this thing hits you, oh, Guru is emptiness. Padmasambhava Sanji said, you are riding horse. The second thought, when you, oh, this is not good, this is sacrilegious, please, Guru, use it here. Then you are dismounting the horse and riding the donkey. It's better, it's still good. You still have at least a donkey. Have a donkey. My suggestion is have a donkey and horse together. Most of the time I'm sure you'll be riding the donkey, but time to time try to leap over on the horse. And if the horse is going too wild, donkey is there. You fall from the horse, not on the ground at least.
In my attempts to uncover this enlightened stuff, maybe I have a little success. For example, I might stop eating chocolate after I've had six pieces rather than having more. And it's, I kind of go, oh, that's great, I'm starting to break down these habitual patterns. And I feel some joy about that. And I'm just wondering, on a practical level, what can I do to change that joy, you know, and getting, seeing that as a...
You should treat this as you are climbing stairs. You know, every time you climb one step, you are higher. But usually, until the last step, we do not celebrate. All the other steps, we take for granted, sort of, isn't it? So I guess you have to learn to ignore them, as how you ignore the steps, the beginning steps. Learn to ignore them. That's what I mean by not to be attached to the result, not to look for result. Brooke?
Is that related to what your father calls stupid satisfaction?
What?
What your father refers to as stupid satisfaction.
Yes, I think so, yeah. Dzogchen Bas call it idiot, stupid satisfaction, they call it. It's good though. It's good. This is a thing. This is the complicated part of the Buddhist practice. What is good? See, since you are aiming higher, you really should learn to go forward, isn't it? You should really go forward. Basically, what you collect as a good stuff happened to be a garbage of someone who is slightly more sublime than you. This is a trash that he would throw. And you will do the same when you reach to his level. Wow, if you know, it's a bit like that. When you reach to the like 10th bhumi, you look back, all the trash that you have thrown. Vajra, bell, guru, sadhanas, vipassana, shamatha, all this garbage that you have exhausted.
In the example where you cultivate devotion on the basis like cooking the egg, you see a cause and effect. The reason why you have confidence in your ability to be cooked is that you've seen the process of an egg being cooked, and you know, like, you wouldn't know that the causes and conditions for cooking an egg actually lead to the cooking of an egg unless you'd actually seen those causes and conditions produce a cooked egg.
Right.
And so, I guess I find it difficult to let go of the result.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing the result is the basis for developing that confidence.
That's okay. That's what I say. My aim is just to create a little hole, that's all. insurance so that you will not be disillusioned. Sooner or later, if you are serious practitioners, you have to hear these things. Sooner or later, somebody will open the door for you and say, "There has never been anything inside. What were you looking for?" Might as well get used to these things. And the great thing is, you have to, until you realize there is nothing, you are the most vulnerable object of all the obstacles. Of course. When the Milarepa, you know, when this is such a good song, and it's such a beautiful incident also. I don't remember all the songs completely, but Milarepa, when this thief come at night, Milarepa's cave, searching, you know, high and low, everywhere, Milarepa said, "I couldn't find," you know, the first paragraph was, "I couldn't find anything during the daytime, you know." "I don't think you will find anything at night." But the second paragraph onwards is so beautiful. It talks about this. A yogi has nothing to gain, including enlightenment. So there is no obstacle. Obstacles will come, you know, like some of the Dzogchen teachings also says, it's like what? Thief in the empty house. You have cleared your house with all kinds of things, you know, you have nothing in your house. You are sitting inside, thief comes, you are confident, you are relaxed, nothing to lose. So, that's what I'm saying, the culprit is something, aim is nothing. We have to work so hard for nothing. So hard, so important. This nothing is so, that's the bliss, that's ecstasy, that's confidence. That will really make you relax. That will make you majestic. That will make you seductive. That will make you, oh God, everything. Attractive. Because you have nothing. So majestic. Nothing to lose. If you have something, nervousness, reduces majestic quality, reduces the radiance, reduces the seductiveness. Let's have a break.